You're listening to Amphibicast.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back. Tonight I've got Mike Novy joining me again, and I hope you remember Mike from episode 13. We got into a lot of different topics, but we didn't quite get into everything that I wanted to. And tonight we're going to talk about a couple of different species. One in particular we're going to talk about, we're going to start off with, is Crusier hyla craspidopus, which is commonly known as the fringe limb tree frog. And it's a species from South America classified as part of the Phylomedusidae family, or in the subfamily Phylomedusinae within the Hylidae family, depending on the taxonomist. Now, taxonomy is a complicated, ever-evolving field, so if you do listen to this episode a year from now, 2 years from now, bear in mind things might have changed. As far as the species goes, I've heard different things. I've heard that they're rare, but the IUCN lists them as least concern. But that assessment was in 2004, so I really don't know quite what the status is. But they're a high canopy species, so from what I've heard, they may not necessarily be as easily spotted as some of the other species. And sometimes that can kind of play a role in terms of how a species is assessed. If it can't visually be seen based on where it is, that can affect it. Regardless, though, they've been bred successfully in the U.S. hobby for a while, and they've become one of the more highly sought after species. And in fact, many of the species within Phylomedusidae are popular, and one I can think of right off the top of my head that everyone knows is the red-eyed tree frog. So Craspidopus is definitely not the same experience as a red-eyed tree frog, but they are related to an extent. Also native to South America is a completely different clade of frogs whose taxonomy is even more complicated. But we know these as glass frogs collectively. And this is the family, which is, oh God, I'm looking at my notes, Centralinidae. And they are at least a dozen genera out there. And collectively, as I said, they're known for their glass-like appearance, their transparent undersides, where many of the organs can be visualized by the naked eye. Members of the family have also become highly sought after among private collectors, and they have some really unique characteristics that honestly make them endearing. In fact, some of them look almost like the stereotypical Kermit the Frog. They've got that sort of Kermit the Frog expression, that eye thing going on, and they're really endearing. I can see why people are really wanting to work with them, and definitely how it's a group of species that you're going to want to see develop further in the hobby. So, as I said tonight, I'm happy to have Mike back on. Mike is from Rainforest Junkies. In case you're unaware, Mike does a lot of shows out there, and he's pretty much the mastermind when it comes to these species. So, if you didn't get a chance, go back and check out episode 13 with Mike. It kind of talks about some general stuff, but tonight we're going to get into really the nitty-gritty of some of these species in terms of how he maintains his collection and what the ins and outs of his daily operations are in terms of keeping them. So, Mike, my man, what's going on? How you doing?
Well, doing great. Just trying to get over this whole COVID thing. with the roaming around the country still, I guess. Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. We have a couple shows coming up that, you still have to wear a mask, but, we do have the Hamburg show that's coming up April 24th and the Cleveland show that's directly after that, that I'll be doing on April 25th. But we are looking forward to the Big Tinley show that's actually happening in June. We're getting by. We're still functioning.
I mean, you depend a lot financially on these expos. I mean, has that kind of taken a toll on your normal day-to-day operations, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that was our saving grace is for some reason, people decided they wanted to buy through the internet and have it shipped. They actually came through with this, first on that one. So I was really happy about that.
Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of vendors.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's really weird because we didn't breed that much this past year because of COVID, and I kind of wish we did because now we got practically nothing in stock compared to what we normally have. And don't get me wrong, it was a nice vacation. last summer was, we barely had anything going on. I'd be, done with everything in like 8 hours. I was really happy with that, but. Financially, you do depend on having those numbers so you can actually have them available. But we plan on doing that this year. We plan on actually kind of Hail Marying everything and getting everything as much as we can to breed, especially we don't know when they're going to pass all these bans. So we figured, well, we'll try and get as much captive bred out there as possible, and people can work with them wherever they're located. So,
yeah, that's a hot topic now everywhere. I mean, here in here in New York, everything is illegal, as I've said over and over and over again. And there's some bills on the table here that might limit or completely eliminate the ability for people to ship in and out of state. So it's pretty much getting to the point where it's every man for himself, so to speak. But you're right. I mean, there's a lot of species out there that need to be built up in captivity so that the average hobbyist can be able to get access to these things.
Correct. Yes. And another thing that's going to be weird about New York is if they do pass that bill, the verbiage is so lame that it would actually mean if you were, I mean, it says everything about shipping, you know, through couriers, but it also states something, I forget how it words it, but basically if you are the courier, that you can actually be fined $2,500 per animal.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't looked at the bill in a while, but the last I checked, which was last month, was, you're right, it was extremely vague, and it at least my interpretation was that it identified the U.S. Post Office as the courier. You know, the way the verbiage was it defined the U.S. Post Office. It said also that FedEx and UPS are also considered couriers, but I don't know if they're affected by the bill or what. But the other thing I don't quite understand is how, I mean, let's just forget the exotics world for a minute, but, you know, things like poultry. I mean, that's actually, if I may be incorrect, but that's partially where this bill started from, was there was a shipment of baby chicks that was being shipped by the U.S. Post Office from somewhere to somewhere, and it was done during the summer, and the Post Office wasn't able to deliver them in a timely fashion, and unfortunately the chicks died. And it became a bone of contention or whatever. But ultimately, the reason for this bill is because USPS didn't uphold their end of the bargain. They were supposed to ship these things, you know, live guaranteed. And then that didn't happen. And then as a result, everybody else is adversely affected by this.
That's the part that bothers me the most, I think. I don't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to say that it, you know, when you were asking about FedEx and UPS, it does state in that through UPS and FedEx and or airlines as well. Like, I ship through Southwest Airlines. So technically, I would not be legally allowed to ship through Southwest Airlines into the state of New York. And this doesn't just affect reptiles and amphibians. It also affects fish, birds, and mammals.
Yeah. So what I'm curious about is, what happens if you have a big box store who, and then their bread and butter is certain species like bearded dragons and ball pythons, even, you know, birds, budgies, finches, etc. Where are they getting these things coming in from? You know what I mean? They have to be coming from somewhere.
They're working it on themselves.
Crazy stuff.
That's basically what the bottom line is every, if this passes in the state of New York, you know, it's going to trickle into other states. I mean, it's a known fact. Once you give the government 1 inch, they'll take a mile. If it does trickle into other states, it's going to be to the point where all the states are going to have their own source. And that's not always possible. You know that for a fact as well, that that's not always possible because certain states aren't just equipped to do chicken farming or, you know, there's not a lot of people that do, you know, tortoises in the state of New York. You know, I mean, it's hard to do because most of those are done outdoors in the southern states. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of variables in that. And I agree with you. It's just, it's completely heinous. You know, it's going to really ruin the pet trade, basically, as if that ever takes place.
I could go on and on and on about that. You know, I mean, I think we both could, but I don't.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. If I could just plug this one in, the one in Illinois is the other one that you have to worry about because that would actually shut the shows down then. That one is against all animal shows, including dog shows, you know, reptile shows, fish shows. I mean, all of them, everything, anything that has to do with animals, they will be shut down. And here's what I'm also seeing is in the state of New York, you know, state of Florida, rather, they actually are trying to do the whole Lacey Act thing again, with big snakes and iguanas, tagus, and a couple of things. I forget what it is offhand. But this bill also states that it gives them emergency power to pass other bans. Now, with this being said, this is like right there, you're hitting all three ways that the pet trade operates. So if you really look at it, what could possibly happen is if any of those bills pass, and I hope people are paying attention to this, if any of those bills pass and then they start trickling in other states, pretty much it'll be a lockdown and the pet trade will just pretty much die. Now, with that being said, I'm going to say this out loud, and I know a lot of people probably disagree with me, but you're going to see a lot of animals go extinct.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting is I came across this actually pretty easily, but the AZA has guidelines for the captive management and husbandry, et cetera, of amphibians. And if you go on Google and you look for it, it's pretty easy to find. And there's a substantial part of that is based off of the private hobbyist. And it actually, I wish I had it in front of me because I'd love to quote it, but just to paraphrase, it essentially says that the private industry, private breeders, private collectors and keepers make a substantial contribution to captive populations within the states, at least, just because they're not beholden to anyone. They can operate their facility. And I know many people who are working with species that were otherwise near impossible to breed in captivity. Yet this person did it. And guess what? This person did it before anybody else at a, a non-pet type facility.
Yeah, like a zoo or an aquarium.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to get too down that rabbit hole. I mean, I actually do want to go down there, but it's just gonna get me and everybody else all worked up. So, yeah. So, I mean,
yeah.
Let's get into Cruzio Hal de Craspid Opus. I mean, if you're listening to it at home, if you can get in front of a computer or something like that, get a visual on how impressive this frog is. It's absolutely amazing. How did they get into the hobby? Tell us the story of how they even came about, because you got involved with them pretty early. In fact, you made a pretty substantial financial investment in them, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One I wish I could kind of take back sometimes, but no, I'm glad I am working with them. I mean, but yeah, I did make a very large investment in that to see if I could kind of, get somewhere with it. And to be honest with you, I did. But the point is I mean, 25 years ago when I first got in this hobby, I should say, actually, it is literally 25 plus years now. I asked people about it and they said, you'll never see that animal in the hobby. And it was really depressing, So, I mean, I've said this before in other podcasts, how depressing it was and all that, but when I had the opportunity, I jumped on it, and I jumped on it and I figured, I'm going to actually breed this animal, bring it in captivity, into the captivity field, where people were buying captive bred animals. And then, we were doing fairly well with that, from 2010, we started working with them all the way to, we'll say about like 2016, all of a sudden people started bringing them in from Peru with tails. And, that actually didn't work out too good because they're a very delicate species when they're young. If they're moved too young, they'll actually stop eating, which was the case in a lot of them. So we did lose a substantial amount of them that actually did get imported into the U.S. But yeah, I mean, as far as working with them in general, I mean, it's still kind of a pleasure to be involved in it. And I called it my Holy Grail frog there for a while. And, now I don't have to worry about calling it the Holy Grail frog. Now I got to find something else.
I'm just picturing what could possibly be next.
Oh, there's a few already on the table. Any of the Hylacertus. If anybody looked up Hylacertus, there's just so many fascinating ones. Like the one that's most people are most familiar with is the Hylacertus tigrensis. It's the newer one that they found in Colombia. It's green and black, and it's got like this tiger striping on it, I guess, hence the name Tigransis. But there's a lot of them that are a lot even more outstanding than that, that people don't even know about. But my fear is if they ever were offered to the U.S., they'd be so ridiculous. I would not be able to make that investment ever again. At that point, it'd be just a rich man's hobby. And I'm not a rich man.
Neither am I. We have expensive tastes in this hobby, but we're not rich.
Correct. Yes. If I had my way, I'd have, you know, a 40 by 60 greenhouse with paddocks in each one of them, you know, for each species and all that. But things don't always go our way.
You do have a greenhouse, though, right?
I do. It's one of those Arbor Freight ones. It's not good for the winter, that's for sure. There's really no way to insulate it properly. I mean, I tried, you know, putting the whole bubble wrap on the inside of it and seeing if I can actually run the heater out there. And it worked up until about the end of November. And then after that, it was like, it was just, you couldn't get it above 68 degrees in there. Yeah, that ain't going to work.
Are you keeping any species out there for breeding purposes or anything like during the summer months?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. From like May to about the middle of October, I'll keep a couple different species out there just to kind of lighten the load inside the house, per se. But it's probably a lot more logical to actually do them out there anyways, because they need such a large room. You know, like the packing medusa, they need a lot of room. The whites, when I used to do them out there, need a lot of room, a lot of water. It's just a lot of air movement for that matter too. So, I mean, you got the rotating, like an oscillating fan in there. And then of course you got an exhaust fan. So when the temperature gets up to about 90 degrees, it exhausts out. And then I got a cooling fan that kicks on at the same time, which actually was neat because it actually cooled the greenhouse down 20 degrees in like literally almost a minute. It was really fantastic. But then I had the fogging system out there as well. So at nighttime it would, you know, start to get, you know, foggy like it does in the rainforest. It was really neat, you know. I'll tell you one thing, if you ever want to see pothos get a 6.5 to 8 inch and about 8 inches across, have it in an environment like that for about 3 months.
That's wild. I've got a couple of pothos that I did keep under like really super high humidity, and I did get not that big, but I got maybe 6 inches across.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what fertilizer you're using too. Believe it or not, I was using recycled tadpole water there for a second.
And
really? I actually put all the tadpole water in this big ass tub, and basically ran a UV sterilizer from that tub to another tub. So it would actually, just in case it was a wild caught species or whatever, it would kill any pathogens that was in there. Because I was like, you know, I'm going to be watering plants, and some of these plants I'm going to be using cuttings. I don't really want any pathogens with it. So I decided to use the UV sterilizer to actually take it from one tub to another. Now, nice thing about that is UV doesn't do anything or, you know, diminish the value of nitrogen. So with that being said, you know, I basically recycled the water and made it safe and watered the plants. And that was one of the reasons I actually got such big leaves on a lot of things and such lush growth. So
that's interesting. I mean, I keep a paludarium with a couple of mossy frogs, Theliodermia corticale, in there. And that's actually the one where I got the biggest pothos growth, because I don't change the water. It's been established for such a long time that I'll add water to it, but I never really have had to pull it out and take it away. So I don't know if that's just the nutrients from their waste is fertilizing the pothos or what. I have no idea, but that's where I get the most aggressive growth.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and again, we were thinking about doing that whenever we do move and we do actually get like a building to do this in. As I was actually going to focus on plants and, you know, recycling the water as much as I possibly can. This way, not only would save on water, but I would actually be giving the animal or the plants a little bit more of a natural fertilizer. I mean, I do use Osmocote on certain things because it doesn't burn the plant. But I found that the tadpole water was actually probably the best thing that I've ever used. You know, try to recycle everything that we use as far as the animal's concerned. Like the tortoises, we actually take the mulch, we put it in the flower beds and all that. And I'll tell you one thing, if you want to grow some fantastic tomatoes and vegetables, use tortoise mulch.
It sounds like it's a good fertilizer.
Oh my God, 26-foot vine.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and it was just all plump tomatoes too. I mean, I was like, man, and there's a lot of undigested proteins and calciums in there, which a lot of people don't realize plants need. So we were actually thinking about setting up a mulch thing for just putting all the tortoise mulch in there, along with the mosses and all that stuff. Usually when you have like a mulching tub and you turn it and you let it sit there and just disintegrate and bake and all that stuff, that and throw the leaves from the yard in there as well. You could actually potentially make a great fertilizer for all your plants outdoors or even indoors if you actually do it right. So,
well, good points. Just to back up a little bit to go and get back to Craspidopus, how are you keeping these guys in? I mean, I know you've got, for everybody out there, if you haven't seen it, there's a Dave Coffin video at Mike's home, basically, where he keeps everything. And Mike, you have a pretty interesting way of keeping everything, which most people might not do. You keep everything on paper towels, right?
Yep. I got a lot of slack for that too, by the way.
Well, it works. I mean,
yeah, it does.
You can't deny the results, but I mean, I've seen you kept your Craspidopus on dry paper towels.
Well, they get moistened once a day, but it's not like wet. You know, you don't want to ever keep your Craspies wet because they like to sit more horizontal than vertical. So when they actually will crawl down onto the paper towel and actually lay flat, that's normal. But if it's kept too wet, they can actually get blisters on their bellies and possibly even red leg. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if that could actually happen. But we change the towels every day. We wipe the sides down every day. Like we missed, as soon as they walk in there in the morning, I missed everybody down. So it loosens up all the sides, you know, all the shed, or if they decided to feed, you know, defecate on the windows or urinate on it. So we can kind of wipe everything dry, you know, to where it's not collecting such a large bacteria load. And we'll switch them into a new tank every other day. But for the most part, we wipe it down to it's like bone dry, get all the shed and everything off of it, and it's nice and squeaky clean again. Put down a fresh towel and then put your water dish and then place them in the water dish to let them crawl out. And it works. You know, I mean, the humidity in the room is anywhere from 70 to like 85%, depending on the time of day.
So obviously, if someone had a different ambient humidity in their frog room, you'd want to do it a little bit differently. So if you didn't have that really high ambient humidity, like let's say like my house, parts of my house go down to like 30% in the wintertime when the heat's cranking. So what would you do in that kind of situation to keep them the way they should be?
Well, you could use half glass, half screen, and then put a humidifier in the room. And you know, the wonderful thing is they do have hydrometers that actually will control it, like a thermostat, but it's like a hydrostat. So if you set it to where you want the humidity to stay around, say 70 to 75%, that's usually your safe zone for like your Craspidopus and a lot of your tree frogs. Now, we can go into a little bit more in-depth part of that as well. With like, say, if we have glass frogs in the cage or in the same room, well, we'd have to go through a little bit different, but we'll get to that in a second. So if you have the hydrostat set at that and you're still kind of like misting once a day, they're actually perfectly happy with that. And it's kind of good to dry them out. Well, it's considered kind of drying them out considering what a rainy season would be. It's good to do that for say 3-4 months at a time. Anyways,
I think a lot of people don't consider where they live naturally. It's higher up in the canopy. I feel like so many of us kind of think that, like, just because it's a tropical frog, it has to be kept, like, super-duper soaking wet. And I know, like, with like, Terribilis, with Phyllobates terribilis, keeping them on a soaked substrate leads to things like foot rot, and they stress out and whatnot. So it totally makes sense that you'd want to keep Craspidopus more consistent with that. I mean, even though it's on paper towels, it's still more consistent with, you know, air exchange and humid air that's not soaking wet.
Right. I mean, Terribilis, when I had those and I was working with them, I had to make sure that I had at least some kind of leaf litter, or there was a lot of universal rock on top of the actual the moss, to where they could hop on that and actually dry off for a second. Because you're right. I mean, they can get foot rot if they're kept too wet for too long a period. And, you know, I mean, their key is high humidity, not wetness. You know, so it's yeah, you're right. It's like the same kind of bonus.
If you wanted to keep Craspidopus in a more naturalistic looking environment, what would you recommend?
A little bit more screen, you know, than glass. Typically with like red-eyed tree frogs, I always recommend if like people are using exoterras, cover like 80% of the top. Whereas with Craspies, you know, back it down 10-15% and just, you know, make sure that there's fresh, clean water available at all times that they can go and soak in at night. Usually if you keep it that way, and then right before the lights go out, there's a misting system, or you hand mist them to aid with shedding so they don't get too dried out. Well, then that's perfect too. You know, you want to make sure all that shed comes off though, that's all. And as long as they're doing that, you should be in good shape. Cleanliness with Craspies is definitely a key though, and it's a little bit more, I don't want to say difficult, but it's a little more challenging when you have it in the tank. You have to wipe the leaves down occasionally because, again, in the rainforest, you know, where they're high up in the canopy, that, you know, that gets rinsed off occasionally by, you know, little downpours here and there, and it's nice, squeaky clean, and they don't have to worry about buildup of shed or anything like that. So in the tank, if it happens and there's too much of that buildup of shed, or say like they defecate on the plant all over it, and they go to lay on it, you know, for their final, you know, like right after the lights click on and they decide to go to sleep, they fall asleep on that, they can actually start to burn them.
Really? Like that's wild. Almost.
Yeah. And it's nitrogen burn is actually quite common with Pac-Man frogs. A lot of people don't change the soil enough. And I don't know if you've ever heard of people, you know, where they get sores on their feet and all that stuff and their stomachs. It's generally due to like nitrogen burn, because it's been so long since that soil has been used or changed rather, that they wind up with that kind of complication.
So what would you recommend for a substrate if you were keeping Crusial Hyla Craspidopus in, say, like a planted Exoterra or a Zoomet or something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you definitely want to make it bioactive. You want to make it a little bit more roomy. You know, they do require a little bit more room than some tree frogs. Like, you know, glass frogs, I mean, you can probably keep them in, depending on how many you had. If you had like, say, three or four of them, you could easily keep them in an 18 cube, no problem. A pair of Craspidopus, I'd probably say no smaller than a 24 by 18 by at least 24 inches tall. And you still got to wipe it down, clean it up occasionally.
So bigger is definitely better.
Right. Yeah, you can't just compress them into a small area. Now, everybody sees the videos and they're like, you haven't been 10 gallons. Well, see, the thing is, they're being cleaned every day or switched into a new tank every other day. So that's being kept a lot cleaner than if they're in a regular, you know, Exoterra that's planted up. And keeping things bioactive, I want to say this too, is not always the right answer. You know, I mean, you can have it bioactive. That does help, but it doesn't ever take away what your true responsibility is to keep these animals clean. You know, it'll take care of so much, but you're going to wind up with problems if you don't do a regular maintenance on it. regardless.
I've had conversations with people about that, and it's become such a buzzword that I think that people feel like if they don't build a vivarium according to that magic template or whatever it is, people tend to have kind of a generic template when it comes to bioactive. And I agree with you. It doesn't always apply in certain situations because...
Well, it makes you lazy.
Yeah. And a lot of times it's also a matter of substrate. So bioactive substrate, or whatever you want to call it, I mean, yes, it'll break down waste and whatnot, and an arboreal species isn't necessarily going to even come into contact with it, but that's not necessarily going to be a substitute for doing basic maintenance on it. And like you said, in the case of Craspidopus, you have to wipe everything down because you're not getting rainfall that's washing everything away and clearing it. So I can totally see what you're saying about having paper towels as a substrate is just completely, it's the same as having a more naturalistic substrate because they're not coming into contact with it the way they would, you know, in another type of situation.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's, I always get that question too, at the shows too, when people go to purchase them, they're like, you know, what size bioactive would you recommend? And I tell them the dimensions and their jaw hits the ground. Why so big? Well, it's not a dart frog, man.
It makes you think about how easy dart frogs are actually easy to, how easy they are to keep in captivity.
Right, right, right. And like, you know, and as I'll say, like I did on other podcasts, doesn't mean that I'm saying that dart frogs are, you know, for dummies. I'm just saying that tree frogs are just way more work. You know, dart frogs are more of a, they're kind of having like fish. You know, you can just do a maintenance on it once every other week and they're fine. You know, I mean, but, and for the most part, they don't defecate or urinate as much as a tree frog. Well, most tree frogs. And I think that's where a lot of people get the wrong impression of how to take care of certain tree frogs. You know, I mean, I've had people ask me, can I keep this, you know, this giant waxy when I was breeding those? They're like, can I keep this in a 20-gallon, you know, bioactive? I'm like, no, we're talking 36 by 18 by 36. That's just for a pair. And that's, you're still going to have to do a lot of cleaning. I mean, they didn't realize how much these things defecate. I mean, when they poop, it's like a Tootsie Roll. I mean, sometimes bigger. It's like a cat was in there, you know?
A cat.
mean, you know, I mean, a small dog, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's, they can, you know, what goes in must come out, you know? So if you're feeding them a lot, they're going to poop a lot. So you got to keep that in mind. And with tree frogs, I mean, they have a high metabolism. So you got to keep them well fed. So
I think another thing that people might not quite get the idea is that when these things go in the wild, it falls maybe 30, 50 feet to the ground. It's not like they're coming into contact with it. It's just, it drops down to the forest floor and it's gone. Yeah. Only don't walk underneath that tree, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I get hit with a brown Tootsie Roll, yeah.
Oh, God.
Hey, at least, well, in most cases, at least it doesn't go splat, you know? You gotta think of that matter.
True, true, true. Since their metabolism is high, what's their activity level like? Can you see them at all? I mean, are they mostly nocturnal? Can you see them out during the day? Do you see them moving around?
For the most part, Craspidopus are probably one of my lazier frogs, kind of like the bicolor, where... and this is why I don't hand feed them either, because they'll stay in the same damn spot and never move if you keep feeding them hand fed. I mean, they literally are training you at this point. So with that being said, I let them go and hunt the food at the bottom of the cage or in a feeder food station with some frogs. So they have to actually get up and walk around and actually be, physically looking for the food. And I think that's good. You know, I don't think that there should be where you're hand feeding them. I think that actually, I mean, it's, I mean, we all love to spoil our pets. I admit that. If I could, I would do that. But the thing is, we have so many of them. But at the same time, I'm glad I don't, because I like to make sure that they're active and they're moving around. You know, you if you're not moving around, I mean, it's just like anything, you know, a body in motion stays in motion. you know, I'm sure that, you know, if they're not moving around and they're not gripping and climbing and all that stuff, they're going to lose that muscle tone and eventually become lethargic. So fat and lethargic too, for that matter. Which you don't want that. You don't want that with anything really. You know, you want to make sure that it keeps moving, that it stays healthy, you know, and it does have good muscle tone and all that. I think that's important.
Yeah, fat frog is not necessarily a healthy frog. It's one of those things we just sort of assume in the hobby. It's just because this frog is like the density of a softball that it's healthy.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, let me put it in this fashion then. Okay, a fat frog is fine as long as it's moving around. Like an active fat frog is good, not one that just sits there like a bump on a log, literally. That you don't want. You want nice thick frogs, but you want them to be moving around. You know, you want them to have a reason to look at, you know. You know, it's kind of like, you know, wrestlers when they go to bulk up for wrestling season, you know, they still keep in motion, you know, but they have such a high calorie. That's kind of what I'm getting at. I guess it's probably a horrible way of putting it, but yeah, I mean, as far as the Craspidopus, though, I mean, if people wanted to keep it in a bioactive, bigger is better, you know, at that point.
What about diet? What are you feeding them?
I feed in only crickets because I can't deal with roaches. I think we discussed that in the last episode. I feed the crickets a pretty good diet, though. I make my own gut load. I actually sell it, too. Because a lot of people seem to like it, and you'll never see a cricket eat it fast, anything else faster. But I try to actually implicate all of their basic needs, you know, and one of the basic needs is a lot of people like over supplement with calcium sometimes. Well, if you give it to them more natural, like say like a calcium citrate, in other words, it absorbs into their bloodstream a lot better than it would be calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate can actually cause intestinal blockage if you give amphibians too much calcium. That's just what I've read. Now, there are some exceptions to the rule, like the bonier species, like they have more of like a bonier plate in their head or something, like ducks, what do they call them? The Tripyrion pestius, I believe that's what they're called, the duck-bill frogs. Or the, well, they used to call it Anuthica spinosa. I think it's called Tripyrion spinosa now. The crown tree frog. They have a bonier structure in their head, so they need more calcium, or else they actually can get metabolic. But most of your tree frogs, like Craspidopus, don't need that much calcium.
What about UV? Since they live sort of up in the canopy, does you ever experiment with UVB, giving them that?
Oh, yeah. It works really well. It actually does kind of intensify the color when they have a little bit more UVB. But the way we have everything set up downstairs, I actually don't use UVB that much. I mean, there's a UVB in the center of the room, but I'm sure by now, I mean, it's like a year old. I got to probably replace it. But basically, I actually give the supplement of vitamin D3 with the calcium, the little bit of calcium that I do use, because I use just RepCal products. I use the Herptovite and I use the calcium with D3 in it. Now, the rule of thumb that I've always gone with, and it seems to have worked for me, is 3 parts Herptovite to 1 part, you know, calcium with vitamin D3. And that's been my go-to for 20 years now. And, I mean, I've tried other supplements like Repashi, I shouldn't say I didn't like it. The animals didn't like it. They seemed to discolor over a year and a half. I used it and they seemed to discolor, not really have good fertilization. Once I switched it back to the RepCal products, it seemed to work a little bit better, you know, a lot better actually. So, with that being said, if you're going to use a UV bulb, I want to actually explain this too, is because it has been noted and actually documented that animals can tox out from too much vitamin D3. So if you're giving them the supplements of vitamin D3, you shouldn't really be using a really powerful UVB bulb. Like 2% UVB is probably your best. that I would actually use at that point. But if you're not dusting with vitamin D3, then I probably would use something like a 5.0 and have it about, you know, say at least 4 or 5 inches above the screen so it doesn't actually burn the animal.
That's a good point. I kind of forget that a while back before, I mean, you probably remember this, before UVB was really developed, we had something called a Vitalite, and it was sort of this massive effort to curb metabolic bone disease before it started. So all those supplements came out with calcium and D3, and then the UVB technology improved to the point where you really don't necessarily need to supplement D3 if you're providing adequate UVB, especially with some species. But we still dose them up on all this D3 and throw, I mean, not for amphibians, but so much, but more for reptiles. You're throwing the supplements along with the UVB, and you have to consider that it's not necessarily getting like the double benefit. You're actually overdoing it.
Correct. Yep.
Have you ever seen these guys in the wild?
No, I actually, I actually do want to go down to Peru and, you know, check out the actual, their actual range and see how their environment is. And there's a friend of mine down there he's actually doing some research on some stuff. I want to actually go down and actually visit him and go see these sites and get more of a worm's eye view, I guess is the best way to put it, on how they actually do act and behave and breed and all that stuff in the wild. So, you know, where it's rainy season, they'll actually come down from the canopy, go to the tree holes, and actually start breeding from there.
Yeah, I was curious about their life cycle, what, you know, how that starts from breeding to tadpole to froglet to adult.
Correct, yes. That's what I want to actually witness, too. And I actually want to do like I did in Costa Rica, where I took the water probe, the temp gun, everything. You know, just really, really get it down and just get more precise, I guess is the best way to put it.
How long did it take you to get these guys to breed in captivity for you?
Well, when I originally got mine, they were fairly young, and I raised them up for a year. They were already at 6 months. Raised them up for a year. They were displaying something before this year and a half was up, you know, as far as like their breeding behavior, the males calling, males wrestling. They do this hop up and down on the males I'm believing it's a dominance thing. And lo and behold, I just started, you know, working them into a rain chamber with a tree hole, which was basically consistent of a bucket with a hole drilled halfway up. And that's where they started laying their eggs. So, I just did the best I could to kind of imitate what they did in the wild. Now, that's the other reason I want to go down to see them in the wild, is actually maybe I can improve that. You know, I think there's always room for improvement.
Can you sex them at a certain point, or is it just sort of a guess?
No, actually, at around 9 months, you could be 100%. If you're on a regular feeding regimen and, you know, they're growing at a consistent level, then yeah, at 9 months, you can actually sex them out for sure, 100%.
By just comparing to and what, like the female's larger, or how do you do it?
Well, yes, the females are larger. They have more of I consider a larger head. And this is common with a lot of tree frogs. The females always seem to have a larger, more blunt head, whereas the males is more narrow, more triangular. Plus, you know, you'll notice the nuptial pads on the males. I did actually make the mistake of one time of selling a enormous male, which I wanted that thing back so bad, but he figured he'd keep it. Generally by sexing them out by size, that isn't always the case. So I do want to point that out. There is such thing as what I call bulls. And they basically are like just a giant male.
One of the things that I find people have difficulty with is they'll get a single frog, like at an expo or from a breed or whatever. And then as the frog starts to mature, they think to themselves, well, how do I sex it now? And you've only got a single frog. You don't have a large group to compare it with others to get an idea. Is there any way to sex just a single frog without another frame of reference?
Well, if it's a male, it'll definitely get the nuptial pads, or it'll start to actually do this little thumping call is what I call it. You know, it's just like a that's what they sound like. And it's very low, but you can, you know, if you're near the cage, you can at least hear them. And you'll actually, if you shine a light at them, like a red light, even though everybody says that they can see the red light, they seem to still call when you're shining the red light on them. And with females, they're not going to really do that. They're not going to actually make a call like that. That's with the Craspidopus. But I'm saying, you know, it all depends on what frog you're actually specifically talking about. There are ways you can kind of, you know, through characteristics of how they behave or what their size is, you can generally tell that that's a male or female.
What about the breeding cycle? I mean, do you have to, I know you breed them for a living. I don't want you to get into too much detail, but is there a conditioning period? How do you get them set up for a breeding season?
Well, I mean, I put everybody through a dry season where I lower the humidity in the room, which is usually around the winter time when humidity is down anyways. I do that for 3 to 4 months. And then as soon as, you know, I feel it's time, you know, I'll start to raise the temperature up and you actually cool it down to where it's like only 75, 78 during the day instead of in the Craspidopus area. That's what we're still talking about. Then I'll raise it up to like 82 to 84 during the day. The humidity shoots up to around 80, 85%, you know, only drops down to 75% during the day. And then it'll spike up to like 85% at night. And that usually encourages them to start to actually develop nuptial pads and start calling. And you can do that any time of the year.
What about the tadpole care?
Tadpole care? It's just like any other tadpole, really. I mean, you run a sponge filter. You can run a sponge filter in the actual tank, like a 10-gallon tank with a clutch of, because they like small clutches, anywhere from like 8 to 24 eggs. So say only like they lay 24 eggs, but only 10 develop and hatch out. So 10 tadpoles in a 10-gallon tank with a sponge filter, as long as you're doing a water change once a week, they tend to do very well. And I do like to put plants in there, like Java fern. Java fern is like actually my go-to because it's so prolific. I can actually grow it and then kind of like just disperse it through different tanks. And then if I have to use it for another tank, then I'll sanitize it with a bleach solution or peroxide solution, whichever I have handy at the time. And then it's safe to use in another tank. Just don't put too much to fry the plant out. Done that.
How long does it take the tadpoles to metamorphose?
Usually if the water temperature is around 78, 80 degrees, which I prefer that over like anything over can actually, they can morph out smaller. It's like anything. If the temperature is too warm, they'll morph out quicker, but they'll morph out smaller and less. I mean, they may look fully developed, but I don't think that they are fully developed, or it takes longer for them to fully develop. I don't know how else to put that, but if you keep it around 78 to 80, it seems that they take 6 to 7, sometimes 8 weeks, but they come out enormous, good eaters. I mean, we've had them morph out an inch long, which is pretty big, you know, for a baby Craspidopus.
You said before that if you move them too quickly, they can stress out and not thrive. What size would you sell them for? What size would you, if someone was going to an expo or whatever, and obviously if they didn't run into you, but if they ran into somebody else, what should they avoid?
Anything that's under an inch and a half. If it's not an inch and a half, eating half inch crickets, I probably would avoid it. Especially if you're a beginner or if you don't have a lot of experience with tree frogs. Like if you have like just a red eyed tree frog and a white tree frog, chances are I probably would say no, I wouldn't do it. And it's just me, my recommendations. I mean, people could do whatever they want, but I mean, I'm just looking out for them and the animal. You know, I mean, I think anything smaller than that, even with people like me or a couple of my other friends that breed Craspidopus as well, we've all agreed is man, you know, even when we did actually invest in some of those import ones that came in real small. And my one friend bought 10. He wound up with 4 that survived. He says that was the most stressful 6 months I've ever had to deal with.
I can imagine. Did you run them through any kind of like, did you do fecals and all that other stuff? Because to me, it seems like it'd be a huge investment that you'd want to protect. Like, what kind of quarantines and procedures did you go through to get them healthy as you could?
And some of them did come in with nematodes. There was, and I don't know if this is just a rumor or not. I hope it is, because I actually hate this word with a passion. Is a lot of them did come with chytrid. Now I don't know how true that was, but that was through the grapevine. There were some people that did actually put up results that yes, that they did have chytrid. That frog actually did have chytrid, and that's how it did die. But then there's other shipments that people tested them, and they tested clear. So I mean, I don't want to put the bad taste in everybody's mouth and, you know, say that, you know, you're just doomed if you get them. If you had the experience, go ahead. You know, I mean, if you're good with like, you know, amphibian medicines, go right ahead. If you're fairly new, I probably would stick with captive bred, you know that the person actually bred them. I would do the research on the person you're buying it from, because the last thing anybody needs in their collection is that dirty word I just said. So
I can see that as being a potential turnoff. The funny thing is, though, is I've done over 30 shows, and I've had a lot of different people on, and the topic of chytrid has come up in different capacities, whether it's in the hobby, whether it's in the wild, whether it's in a lab setting, whatever it is. And I don't think people realize how common it actually is in all aspects of the frog world, whether it's captive, laboratory, wild, etc. It's out there. And to me, it almost seems like people are, I mean, obviously it's not something you want in your collection at all by any means, especially if you have species like Atelopus or something like that, that are not going to do well with that at all. But it's interesting to see how this is going to unfold in the next few years, because I've come across different things. I came across a paper recently, which I didn't get to read the whole thing, but it disputed some of the findings about the lethality of chytrid in certain species, and it questioned the methods of the study that set the precedent. I don't know. I mean, obviously, like you said, it's not something you want to introduce into a captive collection by any means, but I'm pretty sure that it's out there it's probably in private collections, whether people realize it or not.
Right. There's a few species that are they just don't come down with it. And unless you really, really, really stress them out to where their immune system drops, all that stuff. I mean, take the animal, put them in a container, and throw it down the stairs a bunch of times. Again, I'm sure that would probably, do. Not that I recommend it. But, you know, my point is if the animal is in stress, usually it doesn't show signs of it. Just like rhinovirus is another prime one, is there's certain frogs that could just live with that an entire life and they'll be fine. It's other frogs, like, say, that's why I always tell people, frog 101, wash your hands from tank or species to species. And that actually is probably a good rule to go by, because if, say, one frog has rhinovirus and it's perfectly fine with it, doesn't affect their offspring or nothing, it may very well affect another species of frog, especially if it's from a different continent, because it doesn't have an immune system towards that rhinovirus. Same thing with the chytrid. Chytrid, there are different strains of chytrid, and everything that I've read on it stated the same thing. Is certain frogs can live with it, but if it's introduced to another species, it can wipe them out.
Yeah, that's what I've heard as well. And it's interesting. It's become this boogeyman, so to speak. And that's not to diminish the severity of it and how lethal it is, because it does a tremendous amount of damage. But it's, I don't think that it's the apocalypse that everyone makes it out to be.
Right. And there's ways to avoid it. Like if you know the animal is wild caught, there are chytrid recipes online using athlete's foot spray that has 1% myconazole in it. Now, the trick is you've got to let the, when you spray it in the cup, you know, only a little bit so you can actually fill a full syringe. Before you fill the syringe, you got to let that alcohol dissipate. Because alcohol actually jacks the frog up faster than the chytrid will. So you let that evaporate. And I have actually done this, you know, I mean, I do this with all the wild caught species I get in. I'll be honest with you. I don't trust anybody, you know, as far as like if they're coming in imported. If it says that, you know, it's captive bred from, I don't care if it's from Wickery or whoever, I still actually do a chytrid treatment. It does not harm the animal unless you keep it in there for more than like, say, 6 minutes. Then it actually can start to crack the skin from what I understand. So you have to time everything and make sure that you have things set up prior to doing the soak. So you're doing a 4.5 minute to 5 minute soak with this myconazole solution. Now, the way that I'm going to explain this is the way that I read it, and it seems to work pretty good. You take the, you know, the athlete's foot spray, you spray it into a small cup, let the alcohol dissipate for about 20 minutes, you pull it out in the syringe, you put it in the container that you're going to do the soak in, and let it dissipate some more, the alcohol itself. Because there's a lot of alcohol in that, a lot of ethanol. And say about 20 minutes after you've done that, then you put 220 milliliters of water in there, swirl it around real quick, it'll become cloudy. And that means that you're activated. The water is activated with this solution. So you put the frog in there, swirl it around, kind of like let it soak on it. If it climbs the side, kind of like, I mean, I know it sounds mean, but kind of knock him back, you know, to where he's actually soaking in it again. Make sure it really gets into his sides, you know, like right in the creases below, like the armpit and right where the hips are, because that's usually where the chytrid, from what I read, grows the fastest. So if you hit those areas and actually do this treatment for 8 to 10 days, it says 8 days, it can be completely free of the chytrid with this solution. I say go 10. It never hurts it. And ever since I've done that with all the wild caught species that I've gotten, in 2 weeks after I've done this, these animals look completely perfect.
Really? Like, what do you mean? Like, just their overall appearance just looks better?
Their overall appearance, they're a lot more active. Now, I'm not saying that they had chytrid, because I don't even do the chytrid test anymore, because there's a 30% chance of doing any chytrid tests that it could be a false positive or a false negative. So why would I pay $18 for that false negative or false positive when I'm just going to do the treatment that's not going to harm the animal to begin with? And there is a lot of antibacterial properties. And this is what I mean. I think this is what I, you know, mostly think that was wrong with the animal when I first got it, like the import. It was probably just saturated in a bacteria and it wasn't chytrid. Now, bacteria can act the same way as chytrid, you know, like red leg and chytrid, from what I understand, both look the same as far as the appearance of the actual disease. So with that being said, when you're treating for the chytrid and all that stuff, it's actually taking care of some of the bacteria problem that they're having. Or if there is a fungal issue, it may not be chytrid, but it may be a fungal issue as well. So you're actually hitting two birds with one stone. Well, technically three. But after you do this treatment for 10 days, as I do it, and every day you do it, you have it a fresh, sterile environment set up right before you do the chytrid treatment. And basically a dish of water in there with a little spritz on the sides. You don't want the cage too wet. You want to just make it moist and humid. Putting the animal back in there after that and feeding them every day. You know, you're going to throw some crickets away because you don't want to actually put those back in the container. You know, you're just basically reinfecting the animal with whatever problem they had. But the chytrid treatment seems to actually get rid of more than just chytrid is what I'm getting at. Doesn't get rid of nematodes or anything like that. That you're on your own. You go to a vet. Go to a vet. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, dealing with intestinal parasites is tricky. I think that just the way a mammal is going to metabolize a drug is going to be very, very different from the way an amphibian metabolizes it, or a bird or a reptile or a fish or whatever. I think that what happens is they don't metabolize these things quick enough to be as quickly effective as it would be for like a person. Like, for example, like they take like ivermectin. I mean, ivermectin is used in human treatments for parasites. It's used in dogs. And, you know, I don't know if they use it for cats or not. I know the cats have some sort of weird sensitivity to certain things. Yeah, but in any event, they don't metabolize it that fast, and it just kind of sits and doesn't really do anything. So, I mean, I've heard different things from other people about intestinal parasites. I've had some people that have had almost immediate results, and I've had some people who've had a longer course to go through, which can kind of be, I mean, even I'm going through that with a trio of errata that I've been going back and forth on with different treatments to try and get them to put some weight on. They're healthy and they're active. They're just not getting a lot of mass, but I don't know.
There is a mixture. I don't know if I find it, I might actually send it to you of how to use ivermectin. I think Troy actually has it where you can use the ivermectin. You put a drop on their back, and literally within, like, I think 2 weeks, the animal is completely free of the parasite. I that's to my understanding now. I mean, I'm not quite sure if it's a 2 week or a 3 week treatment, but, and it seemed to be safe. The animal did fine afterward, didn't fry him out. Now, if you actually go a little bit above that requirement on that ivermectin, that frog's nuked. That's how sensitive that drug is to these animals. And that's with a lot of things, actually. If you use, like in Panacure, if you don't water it down enough and you go to actually shove, you know, one of those catheters down its throat and inject it in there to get rid of, like, you know, I think that's good for only roundworms, hookworm, and pinworm, whereas ivermectin takes care of all of it, right? Is that to my knowledge? I'm not sure if ivermectin takes care of flatworms is what I'm asking.
Yeah, the research that I read, and that reference that you're talking about with the ivermectin, that was actually Keith Tanis gave me that recommendation. And I also talked about it with Dr. Andrew Logan quite a few episodes back. But yeah, that's where I know Troy did that, and he had a lot of results. He had a lot of positive results where he had I think it was a powder blue that just turned itself around. But to my knowledge, the different sensitivities, it depends on the species of parasite that you're treating. So what my question was to everyone, and I really couldn't get quite an answer, is, well, let's just say we eliminate all these other parasites, but it's tapeworms. I really couldn't find anything in the literature that targeted tapeworms specifically, even the ivermectin and
praziquantrol.
Okay, you just answered my question then.
Yeah, praziquantrol takes care of nematodes, trematodes, flatworms, that sort of thing. And I had a problem with tapeworm, it was actually in a cobalt tinctorius. I had tapeworm, and God, when was that? That was like early 2000. And somebody, one of the vets around here recommended that I use praziquantrol soaks. And I did, and it's really weird, but you let the animal soak in it like a bath almost for like 20 to 30 minutes every other day for 2 weeks. And lo and behold, it got rid of it. So, I mean, I guess the animal put weight on, it was breeding within a month, maybe about a month and a half, but it was breeding at least, and the offspring were fine. But the problem is the tank that it was in, I had to tear the whole thing down because obviously I'm not going to throw it back in that. So I had to have a brand new tank by the time I was done with the treatments and all that. And, it went through a lot of moss because you can't just put them on a wet paper towel. In my experience, wet paper towels are like probably one of the worst things to use for housing frogs, or dart frogs rather. When you're trying to medicate them, because it just seems to collect a lot of ammonia real fast. Whereas moss, it kind of absorbs it real fast and the animal isn't really sitting in it.
That's interesting. Yeah. I've done both. I've done paper towels and I've done moss. I had recently acquired an animal that it did come in stress, and I mean, I'm not going to get into the whole course of it, but in the course of a week, I went from, you know, having it in, not an elaborate, but a lot of sphagnum moss, a lot of hides, a lot of whatnot, and it still wasn't coming around. It still wasn't eating, and I moved it into a paper towel enclosure with some, you know, just some magnolia leaves, a couple of hides and whatnot, and it still just didn't calm down. It just this one frog that really wasn't. Neither of them worked, but I noticed that once I put it on the paper towel as kind of a last resort, because I did some topical treatments, because it had a rostral abrasion that looked like it was getting infected. So I was like, I got to do something. And then it didn't do too well on the paper towel either. I mean, unfortunately, look, you know, it happens sometimes. You just get an animal that it just doesn't acclimate at all. And in the course of a week, despite every, you know, throwing everything you possibly can at it, it just doesn't work out. But I mean, from what I've heard, if I had that situation again, I'm going to avoid paper towels entirely.
Yeah. And you got to change it into a new cage every day too. Cause I think that has a lot to do with it too. Cause if it's stressed out already and it's all right, and it's sitting in its own, you know, fecal or urine, I mean, I think this is going to make matters worse, especially if you have an open wound. I mean, I know they breathe through their skin, but once you break that epidermis, it just seems like they're just prone to anything at that point. It's just like game on. And, yeah, that's why I kind of shied away from the paper towels, the wet paper towels for them, because it just was, you'd have to change it every 3-4 hours, or else, you know, they'd be sitting in, because they're constantly peeing. I don't know if you've ever noticed that about frogs, but they constantly absorb moisture and constantly just urinate. And, dart frogs at least. And, I mean, it's just their circle of life, but us keeping in such a micro environment, I don't think that always is the best way to keep them, unless it's something that you're going to keep clean, you know, but that is a problem though.
It is amazing though, what happens when you have an animal that isn't stressed. I have 3 adult female Patricias, and one of them ended up getting a rostral abrasion. I mean, I've had this thing for years. I don't know what happened. It might have just scuffed its nose or whatever. And it somehow, for whatever reason, it just kind of, this frog will just sort of disappear for like 2 weeks. Every couple of months, it'll just disappear for 2 weeks. And so I'm like, okay, I got to find this thing. So I pulled everything out of the vivarium and I found it. And it had a rostral abrasion on it. I'm like, oh crap, here we go. And I just like, all right, I'm going to pull everything out. I'm going to change all the leaf litter. I'm going to kind of cut back on a couple of things. I'm going to give it a little dish to soak. And it came around perfectly. It healed. It's still got a little bit of, I don't want to say scar tissue, but the color isn't as vibrant there as it was in the past. But just knowing that this animal came around, and the only thing I could equate the other situation to was just the stress of being shipped and what have you.
Yeah.
Well, while we're on the subject of fragile things, things that we don't want to break, don't want to break glass. Let's talk about glass frogs.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. They are. They do look fragile enough to where it looks like if you sneeze in a room, they'll shatter. I currently I'm only working with 3 species, but it seems like all 3 species have entirely different environments. And I probably think that you want to go over that. That's for sure. Is the difference between them.
Yeah. I've never kept them. My only experience with them was I saw a picture of them in a book when I was a kid in like 1988. And I never thought I would ever see one in real life. And now they've kind of become common. So if you want to tell us the different species that you're working with and how you're keeping them, that would be great.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Currently I'm keeping, the Valeri, the Hylobatrachian Valeri, the, Fletchmanni, and then I've got, Coccinella granulosa, and, all 3 of them have they just have completely different temperature requirements, in my opinion. The Valeri like to be kept cool, you know, people already know, but then there's also a lot of stipulation that they don't. Now, when I've kept them above 76 degrees, they stressed out. When I kept them at like anywhere from 74 and under, they did fine. They did beautiful. They were prolific. They were constantly active. Their colors were great. Even when I'm raising their offspring, I don't keep them above 76 degrees. It just doesn't seem like they pan out well. And I think I discussed that in the last episode where the Valori, where we found it, the temperature was like 74 degrees, you know, and of course the air was so sticky that your skin started to condensate. But whereas the Fleshmani were found, it could be as high as like, say, 82 to 86 degrees during the day and then 77 at night, and they're perfectly happy with that.
So which one do you think would make a good choice for someone who wanted to get into, I mean, I know that the family is so diverse, but if you had to pick one that would be, I guess, a little bit more durable for a beginner, which one would you pick?
Well, depending on how their house is. If their house stays cool, then go with the Valori. I mean, they can handle it as well as, I mean, that their cage, when it was in the basement in the wintertime, it gets down to 63 degrees. And that I do know for a fact because I've been down there. It's basically on almost on the basement floor in the corner. And I mean, we get some pretty cold winters here in Ohio. So that basement wall actually gets really chilly. I mean, it's like, you know, if you put your hand on it, it's ice cold. So with that being said, it was close to that. The temperature of the cage, now I think the only reason it was 63 is because there was a pump in there, which was probably naturally warming the water. So that's probably what kept it at 63 degrees. But it was like maybe 68 during the day when the light would click on, because even though LEDs aren't really meant to provide heat, I think that they still boost up the temperature of the cage if it's, you know, sitting on top of it, by about, you know, 4 to 5 degrees. So, I mean, I'm sitting here with a temp gun and, you know, water probe. The water, actually, there's a water thermometer in there as well. And, you know, the water was reading at all times 63 degrees. Now, with that being said, is the water's been as warm as like 72, the tadpoles still did okay. They did pretty good. You know, they morphed out a little faster, but again, a little smaller, and I didn't like that. So I try to keep it at around 68 degrees, and they actually come out perfectly fine. So if you have a cool house, that probably would be my first choice. Now, if your house gets, you know, it stays right around the mid-70s at all times, and it can possibly spike up to 80 once in a while, the Fleshmani.
Are you keeping them in, I mean, you mentioned a water feature before. Do you keep them sort of semi-aquatic or in a paludarium, or how would you keep, like, how do you keep them?
I keep mine in a paludarium.
All three species?
And the argument.
Three species?
No. Well, yeah, I mean, all three species, but not together. No,
yeah, that goes without saying.
I kind of misunderstood.
I'm sorry.
That, but, no. That's me. That's on me. I've had a long day. The way that I keep them is mostly water on the bottom. I have a floater feed station, which is basically, if nobody ever heard the other episode, it basically is a 3.3 liter Tupperware container or Rubbermaid container without the lid. And I fold a towel, put it on the bottom. I put the, well, for the Fleshmani, I use crickets. For the Valori, which I want to go over this too, the Valori feed fruit flies that are dusted constantly. And the reason is because since they like to be kept so cool, I tried the pinhead thing a couple of times, and they would prolapse. This is the Valori I'm speaking of. And I think it's because they like to be kept so cool that they can't metabolize the actual cricket. So with that being said, I feed them just fruit flies, like the Heidii fruit fly, and they actually do fine. They actually do pretty good like that. And what I have is like planters, and I use universal rock for this, but I use like planters, like I'll core out the actual rock and then I'll drill holes in the bottom for drainage, put some hydrogen or the clay balls halfway up and then fill it up with moss and then just put cuttings of pothos or philodendron in there to let it vine down. And that's where they seem to like to hang out on it anyways, the actual plants, not the glass itself, but the plants itself. And where I put the fruit flies, I put it on all the planters, and I put it in the feeder float station. And that's how I actually feed my Valorite. Now with the Fleshmani, they seem to do better on 1/8-inch crickets. They'll eat fruit flies, but it seems like they keep the weight on better when you feed them crickets, which I think that just goes without saying anyways, with a lot of frogs. And I've actually fed as big as a 1/4-inch crickets to my adult Fleshmani, and they still would choke those things down and still digest them fine. So I think that what that is because their temperature, their cage gets up to about 82, 84 during the day, and at nighttime it only drops down to 77. So there is that fluctuation, but it doesn't get so cool that they can't digest the actual cricket.
That's interesting. I never would have even thought about that, how the ambient temperature plays such a role in their ability to metabolize different prey items.
I think it's important for any animal to have a daytime high and a nighttime low. If you keep your snakes all the same temperature, like people who have snakes, and they keep them all the same temperature, eventually they're going to, you know, have some problems if they don't have a drop, you know. So, which I think everybody does have it because they say that they got the bottom heat, but, you know, snakes can thermoregulate. So if they go to another side that's actually cooler because they don't have to digest a prey item, then that's fine. If they need to digest, they'll actually go to another side that's warm. Well, frogs, on the other hand, sometimes don't always have that there. They're not really thinking. So it's not like you can have like a heat lamp on one side for the Valorite tank, because in many cases that would actually, if they did go over there to try and digest, they probably would dry out.
Can you keep them communally? I mean, like what size of a group could you keep any of these species in?
Oh, absolutely. Like my Valorite tank, I started off with 10. I say this because I didn't know they were breeding. And when I went to go move them, Dave Kaufman came over and I just put them in there. And I started off with 10 and I wound up with like, I don't know, something like 26 or 28 of them that I pulled out of their old tank. And I just, from that point on, I started actually clipping the leaf out with the adult male on it and carefully hanging it above water. And hopefully he would stay, but I wouldn't clip it out until it was at least like ready, almost ready to hatch, like 2 days in. So, with that being said, you know, they don't seem to, I mean, they do the little wrestling thing once in a while, but nobody ever dies, which is nice. It's kind of fun to watch. Cause again, like, you know, with most tree frogs, it's like WWF, you know, you just want to get a beer and popcorn and watch. Well, Fleshmani, same way. They're not really that bad as far as being territorial. I mean, they do have calling wars back and forth. I've had 3 males on top, 1 female. That was kind of funny. They seem to do better in groups. Like they actually, the way that I've read it and actually heard about it from other people that actually witnessed them in the wild, is that they all congregate together, which is common with most tree frogs.
How big of a clutch size do you get?
Depending. With the Valorite, I've had as many as 36. With the Fleshmani, out of 1 female, I think the most I've ever seen was somewhere around 20. But it seems like the Fleshmani lay more than the Valorite do. And it seems like the Fleshmani don't take as long to hatch out as the Valorite. So again, I think that has a lot to do with temperature. Because it's a warmer temperature, they obviously would hatch out, they would develop faster.
And when they lay their eggs in the wild, they lay them over a water source, right? And then the tadpoles just sort of kind of just fall down off the leaf into the water. Is that how they do it?
Yep. Yeah, they just pop out of the egg and drop right into the water. Now, a friend of mine just told me that he actually found a clutch that was, this is his word, around 20 feet above the water.
Wow.
Right, yeah. And I'm like, I'm worried about having a tall enough tank, you know. They're laying them 20, 30 feet above the water, you know, in the wild. So And I travel, you know, I can imagine being that tadpole hatching out, screaming all the way down to the water. Like something out of a cartoon or whatever. But then, you know, I also have another species called Cochranera granulosa, like to be kept warmer. And I say this with a lot of confusion, too, is they're found mainly up at the top of banana trees in the wild. And the area that they were found, I actually did this in Costa Rica, where I actually temp gunned a gecko that was at the top of a, because we were, you know, on the second floor, and it was the top of the actual banana tree that I seen this gecko. And I'm like, I temp gunned him, and he's somewhere around, you know, 90s, you know, the lower 90s. And here I find out that's where the Cochranera granulosa like to hang out as well. So the way I set them up is I literally have a spotlight, a 50-watt spotlight that actually is shining through the glass onto those leaves, and actually got the temperature finally up to about 88 degrees now. Now they're ice blue, but if they're kept too cool, they actually turn yellow. It's stressing.
Are they all clear to the point where you can see their organs? I mean, that's kind of what people generally associate.
On the other side, yes.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. All of them are, like, you know, very transparent on their bellies. You can actually see the eggs when they're forming, which is really neat. Again, you know, I mean, they don't like to be, this is the thing that really weirds me out about the Cochranera granulosa. They do not like to be kept wet. Whereas the Fleshmani and the actual Valori appreciate a little bit more moisture.
So how would you keep them similar to, I mean, to me, it sounds almost a little bit more like Craspidopus. Is that how you would sort of keep them?
Kind of, yes. Yes. Where if you got the actual temperature of the cage up to around, you know, the mid-80s, upper 80s during the daytime and then mid-70s at night, I think that they would actually, I mean, they seemed, I mean, I've had mine for close to 4 months now, and I've gradually been, you know, I actually gradually got that temperature up when I first got them, and the highest I ever got them inside the cage got 95 degrees. And I actually panicked. I was like, oh my God, where are they? And I look, and they're right there in the actual beam of light. They actually piled in the right in front of the actual beam of light of that spotlight, and we're just soaking it in. And I'm just like, they're ice blue. I mean, they're just completely ice blue. And everything that I've read on that, that means that's kind of their, if you could say it, happy color.
The happy color.
Well, because when a Cochranera granulosa turns yellow, you've got issues. It's stressing out. So that's one thing that's nice about them is you could tell when they're not doing so hot and you better do something about it, is their color changes. But when they're ice blue and they're plump and, you know, you can, you know, the males are starting to call and all that, I mean, they're happy. I mean, I don't think that there's any animal on this planet that would actually show brilliant colors like that and be calling and be sick. And these were wild caught.
Did they acclimate well to captivity from being wild caught, or did you have a bit of a trial by fire with them?
Actually, the person I got it from, Jay Andres, did a really good job of, when he gets them in, he gets them in wild caught, he actually will hold on to them for at least a month in most cases. In this case, he had these for a month and a half. And if they need attention, he'll actually, you know, I've actually went over some ways of treating animals when he first gets them in, and he's actually followed suit with it. He actually pulled through and showed that he could provide. So I'm looking forward to getting some more species from him that he's going to be actually getting from Peru to actually start breeding. I just acquired the Dendrophis saracinensis. Which I don't know if you're familiar with those.
No, I'm not.
Okay. Basically, it's a gigantic version of a clown, except it has orange, you know, flanks on it, yellow flanks, has a little bit more brown on it. And I found once here's the thing is certain animals have their, as I call it, happy colors. The brown actually turns more of a lavender when they're actually in perfect health.
That's got to be beautiful.
Oh, I could send you a picture right now of the Perinum plexus. And basically, I want to try and get as many species like this as possible before they stop the exporting and actually start breeding it. And, you know, try and get as many captive bred into the States as possible. At least that's the goal. You know that anything can go wrong. But yeah, I mean, as far as like your glass frogs, go back to that. I mean, I kind of like strayed there for a second. Yeah, I mean, there's different ones that have different requirements. Now, I don't know all of them, you know, what their requirements are. Just the ones that I received and actually did research on. There's GPS coordinates that people have found them and actually did temperature readings I found. So I was like kind of glad that they had that available. But yeah, the way I keep all my glass frogs is all the plants are hydroponically grown in the water. There's water circulating with a filter. And there is a little bit of air movement, you know, through ventilation, you know. So I think that that's probably important for a lot of people to remember is make sure you do have some ventilation, not a lot, but some ventilation so you can have some air movement in there where you have less problems, regardless of what species of tree frog you have.
Do you ever use fans or anything to artificially circulate the air around?
Not the pancake fans that I know a lot of dart frog guys use on some of the histo tanks, which I'm actually thinking about getting involved with figuring out how to do that with a couple of my dart frogs since I'm getting into dart frogs again. Like your Pomelio or Faga or Savatica or Historonica, those prefer a little bit more air movement because they're usually up in the canopy by the bromeliads. But I do have in each room, I have an oscillating fan. And this way it actually circulates the air and kind of blows into the tank lightly, not harshly. And you still get a, you know, a good, you know, air exchange and all that as well.
I think that's one of those things that people underestimate a lot is the value of air exchange, because recently what I did was I kind of refitted the tops on a couple of my larger vivariums because, I mean, these were actually just 40 breeders, and I got tired of constantly looking at condensation on the glass. I'm like, I can't see these things. So I allowed a little bit more ventilation, and it was interesting. The frogs weren't as visible as often, but when they were visible, they were much more active, just with that extra airflow coming through.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. As long as the humidity factor is there, you know, you can have the air exchange without a problem. You know, and with dart frogs especially, I mean, you know, the way that a lot of people don't realize is if you go and set them up with a partially ventilated top, of course, you're going to have to make that fruit fly proof. I do want to specifically say that. So you got to get a really fine mesh. I would recommend aluminum mesh. And, yeah, I mean, it does wonders. It really does.
We're having the fruit fly apocalypse here right now. Actually, I'm notoriously sloppy with my fruit fly habits, and we're finding them. We're finding them. And my wife said, she's like, these things are everywhere. I said, where are they coming from? I'm like, I don't know. They came from outside. And they ended up in the washing machine. So my damage control, for anybody out there, if you have this problem, don't do like I do. despite how knowledgeable I may sound, I'm not.
Now, when you say don't do what I do, you mean be sloppy with the fruit flies or lie to your wife?
Both. Well, technically it's not a lie because she knows what's happening. I lie to myself by admitting it's not a problem. But what I do is, yeah, I take deli cups, like the 16-ounce. I mean, you can use anything, really, but the 16 or the 32-ounce deli cups, you take some apple cider vinegar with a little drop of dish soap, swirl it around a little bit, cover it with plastic wrap, poke a little hole in the middle, and make sure the plastic wrap is secured with like a rubber band or something like that, and you'll catch a lot of them. I actually keep a gallon container of vinegar on the top of one of the shelves in my frog room just for like damage control, and you'll catch a lot of fruit flies in there. So that mitigated some disasters, but it's still a work in progress. So
right. Yeah, there's a few people that actually use beer, which I made the comment that just sounds like alcohol. But if you actually take like a small, like, I don't know, Dixie cup of beer and actually place it above the, like, next to the tank or on top of the tank, chances are they'll all find the beer and actually drown in it. And it seems to work for some people. So vinegar or beer actually would work, depending on how you feel about the smell of either one of them, I guess. But that's actually the way that you're talking is the way I got rid of carrion flies.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I should have been the Orkin man, because once I read up on what their weaknesses was, I used it against them. Those carrion flies are nasty. Now, with dart frogs, if they fly into a dart frog cage, well, then they're toast, you know. The dart frog will actually eat them. But they have a tendency of laying their eggs in the nostrils and cloacas of, like, the bigger tree frogs or geckos or snakes, you know, things that aren't going to move around that much. And they can actually kill your animal.
Yeah, that's not a problem that I want to have. So I'll keep my little cans of vinegar and whatnot out.
Right, yeah. And the way I got rid of mine was they're attracted to blue LEDs, for one. Well, I think it's the females that are attracted to the blue LEDs. So what you want to do is you want to get like a 16-ounce deli cup with a lid, take a hole punch, and punch holes that are big enough, you know, like probably like an 1/8-inch size hole punch. Punch holes in the side, put about a 1/2-inch of that, you know, apple cider vinegar in it. Drop either a dead pinky or a dead cricket in there and let it float. They'll find that, lay their eggs on it, and then mark the date on it, because they actually hatch out in 7 days. So if you actually marked it, say, the 6th, you do it on the 6th day, which would be the 12th, you would actually just take it, flush it down the toilet, put a new, make a whole new trap. But you have this light pointing at it, like those little LED night lights pointing at it, and that's all they do, is they just want to find that and just lay their eggs in it.
That's pretty ingenious. I'm picturing almost like a bug light. For anybody out there who remembers,
that's kind of what it is. I mean, they just kind of like get mesmerized by it, and they get attracted to it, and that's boom. They go and they lay their egg inside there, and, you know, their eggs inside of there. Sometimes, most of the time, the males will follow them in there and drown in the actual vinegar, and she's just laying her eggs. Now, the typical, what they also call them drain flies. Your typical drain fly has a 22-day lifespan. So if you do this for several months, eventually they're just going to disappear. And they do.
You know, I'm going to tell you something, Mike. I worked for a sewage company for 15 years. And getting rid of these things was the biggest, like, exterminators wouldn't touch them. Like, nobody would bother because they were almost near impossible to get rid of. So the information that you're giving me now, just so you know, is invaluable to so many other people in so many different disciplines, because this is the first way of getting rid of them that I've ever actually heard.
Right. Now, that's if you can contain how they're getting in the first place. Usually it's like the middle of summer. That's when you mainly have the problems. Or if you're getting crickets from a shitty cricket company, I'm sorry if I swear on air, but it's a crappy cricket container or cricket company rather, and they come in with carrion flies. I'm not going to even get into who I've gotten those from. It's probably going to get me in trouble if I say the name of them, but that's how the cricket or the actual carrion flies were coming in, or drained flies, whatever you want to call them. And that's how I was able to contain it. They weren't actually coming up through my drain. Now, during the summertime, yes, sometimes they do actually come up through my drain. Now, the way you could get away with that is if you did pour once in a while bleach down the actual, just like a cup of bleach down into your drain, like once a week, that usually kind of eliminates them from coming up through your drains.
It won't kill the larval stage though. No,
that's why you got to do it like once a week, you know.
Yeah, because I remember going to calls where people would be, and just to put this in perspective, just so you, I went to a job once. Outside of the Long Island area, people have septic tanks. So we have something here called cesspools, which is much, much worse than a septic tank. It's basically a gigantic igloo in the ground full of sewage. Well, in any event, we went to go pump these tanks out in this parking lot. And I go there with my supervisor, and I was going to give him a hand. And the cesspools had flooded, and basically flooded the whole parking lot with sewage. And we pulled in, and I said, what is that? Because the surface was moving. It like pulsating, and we pulled in, and it must have been billions of them, billions of drain flies just took flight and did almost like a flock of birds and did this circle in the air and then came right back down again. It was the most impressive and disgusting thing I'd ever seen at the same time. But they're not pleasant. But that's interesting about the trap being able to time their life cycle, and that's wild. That's, I've never heard of anybody being able to develop a way to get rid of them like that. That's that sophisticated.
Well, I mean, like I said, it worked for me. Plus, at the same token, you do have to clean constantly around the house, because if they find one dead cricket, that's it. I mean, it's like you just started another population of them. So we did have to do some extra cleaning around the house, because, I mean, you'd be amazed where crickets, you know, if you got like a large collection of frogs and you get 20 to 30,000 crickets a week, you'd be amazed where those damn things hide and die, you know. And then, of course, you know, if you have spiders that accumulate in your house too, which I'm battling, this is why I want to have the building. So this way it's all out there. I don't have to worry about it in my living space. But yeah, I mean, if you keep up with the cleaning, you usually have less problems. Now, when you have a bioactive setup for tree frogs and you have carrying flies invade there, it's almost to the point where you have to actually take the frogs out and just drop a dry ice in there and bomb the thing, you know, and that usually definitely kills all the adults. You know, the CO will definitely kill all the adults if you suffocate the cage. Also will kill your bioactive, though. It's the only problem. But that's another reason we don't like going bioactive, because in our house, because, man, the carrion flies would just, man, it'd be like a petri dish for them. So, you know, because they love moist soil. They love, you know, if a frog takes a poop, the first thing they attack and start laying their eggs. Boom. You got larvae all over the place.
I'm just picturing selling those at expos now, like little deli cups full of carrion flies. Here's your bioactive starter kit.
Oh, God. But like I said, if they land in the dart frog cage, that's it. They're toast. You know, I mean,
yeah. But I mean, after dealing with them for all those years, it's definitely a headache you don't want to have, but
no.
So, Mike, we're getting kind of towards the end, and I wanted to just touch on one of the projects that's not necessarily frog-related, but something that you and I had talked about before we kind of started up tonight. You're kind of getting back into the music business, doing your own, I guess, just so everybody knows, when you have a podcast, when you have a YouTube channel, whatever you have, whenever you're using any kind of music, it's you, legally, you can't just use somebody else's music. You have to either pay for the rights or not get caught stealing it. Well, I license music for the intro for this podcast. I know a lot of other people do it as well. They have YouTube channels, etc. So, Mike, you're kind of getting into that niche of producing music for presenters like podcasters and YouTubers. I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about that venture before we wrap up?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's something that kind of like got back involved with it. I mean, I originally played guitar and worked in a studio with a sequencer, worked with a lot of rap and R&B, which was kind of interesting when some of them would come in and actually look at me and they could see this guy with, you know, extremely long hair down to his, you know, buttocks. And they're like, this guy is going to be producing my stuff. So that was kind of interesting. But I did learn how to work the sequencing and all that stuff through that kind of music. And it was very, very fun and very useful, because you could actually create a lot more than that once you get a little bit more into kind of like themes, you know, or drama themes, you know, like soundtracks and all that. And so basically what I was attempting to do is more or less like creating music for, like, say, a commercial ad or for YouTube videos or for podcasts and all that stuff. And basically this way, I mean, we probably won't be up and running fully for another year, but because I want to have a bunch of things that people can pick from, say, you know, hey, get a sample of music and see if this is what you want in your background, or if you custom make the music. And I think that'll probably pan out to be something, you know, not entirely profitable, but at least fun, and, you know, give me a little bit more of a peace of mind than cleaning frog crap all day. So, yeah, it's just something that I kind of figured I'd tinker back into, and it seems to be working out right now. We've got two podcasts. Well, one podcast has an intro written by me, which is Nick Polanski. That's Put It to the Scale. And then the other one is, it's actually in the same video that Dave Kaufman did. He actually put my music in it. And of course, you know, since it's all rainforest and reptile stuff, it was all jungle music kind of. So that's just part of the realm that I can kind of work with. I do have a tattoo studio right now that I forgot to tell you about this too. There's a tattoo studio in Seattle that I'm going to be writing a commercial ad music background for. And of course, that's more of like a gothic, you know, something a little off-putting to some people, I guess. But it'll sound a little bit more gothic, more Nine Inch Nailish, kind of, I guess, the best way to put it. Just, you know, something dark, I guess. And they want it dramatic and powerful and all that. You know, I mean, it's just basically typical artistry. You know, so, and I think that one will be fun. That'll be fun. I've already pitched some ideas, and he's just anxious to listen to it now. So, as soon as I get done with that, I'll probably actually put that up on Facebook to go check out that tattoo studio. I mean, the guy that works there, Brandon, he's just a phenomenal tattooist. I've seen some of his work. He does portraits, for crying out loud. So anybody that can do portraits on somebody's skin, that's pretty talented.
Yeah, portraits is a whole animal unto itself. I mean, I've mentioned it before. I mean, I'm covered from, like, you know, not head to toe, but from like chest to ankle, so to speak. And I knew a lot of people in the industry, and anyone will tell you, if you can do portraits, you're worth your weight in gold, because it's not, I mean, that's not to talk down to people who don't do portraits. There's a lot of artists who are great. They just don't do portraits, but portraits is one of the more like highly coveted skills among artists out there.
Yeah. It's a lot more complicated. The shading, everything. And like you're saying there, I mean, the tattoo artist that did me, I mean, he did frogs, and, you know, on my arm, and he did them exactly like the photo was. I mean, he's perfectly like the photo, but it wasn't like the photo as far as an actual portrait, but it did look very, very similar, and it looked like spot on. So you get the idea. Well, the idea of like all the tattoos I have, I don't know what your theme is, but mine was going to be every frog that I bred.
That's a lot of tattoos then.
An arm and a chest and a back to do. It's a lot of frogs.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing this for over 20 years, so now I'm like, space is a premium on me now. I got some decent real estate that's still up for grabs, but So.
Yeah, and it's expensive to get tats, too, if you go to the right person.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so you get what you pay for. Keep that in mind, people.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
But yeah, it's just, yeah, but going back to the music, I mean, that's just something that I've always had a passion for, but I had to quit because I got carpal tunnel, and finally just, you know, said, you know, what the heck, you know, let's try and, you know, tinker back into it again, and it's been working out pretty good, you know, a lot of synthesizing, that right there has been really, I mean, some of the synthesizing programs that they have now are just off the charts. I mean, you could really produce some amazing music on it. And the sound quality is a lot better than it was back in the day, that's for sure.
Yeah, I remember the days of doing reel-to-reel recording where you actually recorded on a tape. And when you spliced segments of the tape together, you used Scotch tape to splice the segments together.
Yeah.
The old days.
Yeah. Well, now it's like with each track on the computer, I'm still learning it. I mean this program is a lot more technical and a lot more bells and whistles than the old program from back 25 years ago at Fame City Studios. I wonder if that place is still around. But yeah, I mean, they were using an Atari 5200 with a program called Prodigy. You know, and now you've got, you know, Mac has got so many different programs that you can use through them, and even some of your PCs have programs that you can use. They're so complicated, you got to be an engineer to use it. So it's going to be interesting, but every time I get on that thing, I learn at least two or three new things, and I still haven't even scratched the surface. So that's why I figured, you know, about a year from now, I should have a lot of it under my belt. Probably still won't have it mastered, but at least I'll have a lot better capability of making some erratic changing, you know, throughout the music, and it can even make it more dramatic sounding as time goes. So the drumming part is actually the funnest part for me, even though I'm not a drummer.
Yeah, that's a whole other, I could never, I didn't do well with percussion.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you have rhythm, that's one thing. But to have rhythm and actually the ability to sit there and stretch your arms out and move them as fast as those guys do, if you're a really good percussionist or drummer, whatever you want to call it, that just takes talent, you know. And that's why drummers are so hard to find now. But the you know, the standing joke is, if you're a musician, I'm sure, you know, the drummers out there are probably going to really boo me on this one. But how many drummers does it take to put in a light bulb?
How many?
None. There's machines for that now.
That's.
Oh, you know, yeah. The other ones, you know, there was a bunch of musician jokes like that. How many musicians does it take to put in a light bulb? One to hold up, the rest to drink it to the room.
That's great.
How many guitarists does it take to put in a light bulb? One to put it in, two to say, yeah, that was pretty good. The rest to say, I could have did it better.
That's great.
You know it's true.
I do. I know. Well, listen, Mike, it's been a blast as usual. Yeah, you're always a great guest. I always love having you on the show. So, you know, guys, gals, everybody else out there, check Mike out at his next expo. Mike, what's the next expo you're going to be vending at?
April 24th at the Hamburg PA show. They call it the North Berkshire show. North Berks Reptile Show, rather. The one that's following right after that is the day after that, so it's going to be a long weekend for me. It's the Cleveland Reptile Show, and that one is growing, and just extremely fast. I mean, it's just, he moved it to a different location. It's at the Medina Fairgrounds, and it is so much cleaner, more open. He has the potential of actually making that into a super show by opening up the other side if he wanted to, and I think there's talks of him actually doing that. And it's going to be the other thing I want to kind of point out to people is if you do attend the Cleveland show, please become a U.S. ARC member at the U.S. ARC booth that they're going to actually start there. At least I hope they're going to start that. They were talking about that in the last show. And this way you can be informed in the laws that they're trying to pass nowadays and vote against them, so they don't take your rights away of keeping animals.
Yeah, support US ARC. So, I mean, I'm a member, just so you guys know. I pay, I I'm a paid member. So if you are out there and, you know, think of it like union dues, okay? You want to have the rights to keep these things. Well, USARC protects our legal rights via attorneys, and attorneys don't work for free. So pay into it, pay your dues, and try and take care of yourselves and the hobby in general. And, you know, hopefully they'll be able to advocate for us as best as they can, but that's dependent upon our support of them. So.
Right. Right. And believe it or not, the USARC member team does not really make much off of it. They do this out of the kindness of their heart. You have to keep that in mind. They make a lot of money at these expos, you know, like the NARBC show, the auctions and all that stuff. But that goes right back into fighting for our rights. And they have done a really great job in the past. This last year, with all the shows not being there, they had no way of getting any money. We had to kind of try to help them out by advertising for them and telling people, look, just become a student member, you know, which is $20 a year. I mean, I'm just a bronze member. It's $40 a year for that. But any little bit helps, you know, and it's people like they say, there's more strength in numbers, and the more people that actually get on board and kind of help them out, you know, especially if there's an auction at a Rexpo or whatever, your best bet is to kind of try and help support them, you know, buy shirts occasionally, you know, for your loved ones or whatever, you know, whether you're going to work outside on them or, you know, throw darts at it, at least you're spending money to kind of help them out. The way that they're trying to pass these bans, I mean, there's been more bans passed or not passed, actually haven't been passed. Hopefully they don't. But there have been more bans that have been proposed this year than there has been in the last 4.5 years, which is actually a proven fact. So yeah, get on board with them and support USARC.
All right, everyone. I want to thank Mike again for joining me. It's been an enlightening show. I hope you guys appreciated it, enjoyed it. Mike's always a great guest. So I hope you all take care of yourselves out there. Join USARC. All right. Catch up with you guys again soon.